This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests, Joel and Ethan Coen, wrote and directed the new film Inside Llewyn Davis. The Coen brothers also wrote and directed Fargo, The Big Lebowski, O Brother, Where Art Thou, No Country for Old Men, A Serious Man, and True Grit. Inside Llewyn Davis won the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival. It's nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy, and an Independent Spirit Award for Best Feature. New York Times film critic A.O. Scott made it number one on his top 10 list. Set in 1961, Inside Llewyn Davis stars Oscar Isaac in the title role as a folk singer in Greenwich Village just before Bob Dylan comes on the scene. He's known in the clubs, but isn't particularly successful. He used to be half of a folk singing duo, but his partner recently committed suicide. The solo album Davis subsequently recorded didn't sell. He's broke and sleeps on the couches of friends who are losing their patience with him for good reason. He has a way of sabotaging friendships as well as professional opportunities. In one scene, Davis listens back to a track from the album of duets he made before his partner's death. Here's that track with Marcus Mumford singing the role of the late partner.
If I had wings like Noah's dove, I'd fly the river to the one I love. Oh, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well. Well, I had a man strong and tall. Moved his body like a cannonball. Oh, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well. I remember one evening.
Ethan Coen, Joel Coen, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why did you want to make a film about a folk musician in 1961?
Well,
sorry I asked.
Why did we? We had a very early thought. I mean, early meaning well before we ever wrote the script, so a number of years ago, where we thought, supposing Dave Van Rock gets beat up outside of Gertie's Folk City in the Village in 1961. That's the beginning of a movie. And we thought, okay, yeah, that's, why would that happen? And we couldn't really figure out why that would happen. Who would beat up a folk singer is sort of the problem of the issue. So we put that thought away and came back to it periodically over the next couple of years and eventually worked it out.
Dave Van Rock, for those who don't know, and probably most don't know, is a folk singer. He's kind of the biggest person on the scene in 1961 in the folk revival in Greenwich Village. Biggest person on the scene until Bob Dylan showed up. But sort of in our mind, he was the kind of, in quotes, the generic folk singer until we kind of figured out who the main character of the movie actually was and who actually was beating him up and for what reason.
So how did the character start drifting away from the original idea of it being Dave Van Rock?
We were never interested in doing a biopic. That was never the ambition. So the question was, we wanted to make a movie about a folk singer. Who was he? And we did draw on certain aspects of both Van Rock and other people like Jack Elliott from the period. New Yorkers who came in from the boroughs and were singing in these basket houses in the Village in 1961.
I don't think I've ever heard the expression basket houses.
Yeah, I guess you don't hear it anymore. Why would you? It was in a lot of these coffee houses where they played music, folk music, or whatever kind of live performance. They would pass around a basket for tips, and that was the performers. That was the total of the performers' pay.
So where does folk music figure into your lives?
Well, now or...
No, then.
It's, it's when taken over.
Yeah.
It's a direct descendant of the music that's in O Brother, Where Art Thou. It's the kids in 1961 sort of discovering that music that's in that movie, which we've, you know, so we've always been interested in those musical forms, and we've always been interested and grew up on the music that grew out of those forms. which is rock and roll. So that's the music we grew up with. And Bob Dylan. When we were kids, you know, Bob Dylan was a top 40 radio artist. We were listening to him on the radio like everyone else was.
So what point in your lives did you discover, like, folk music or blues or traditional music?
Let's see. Yeah, I got to tell you, it's actually, I like kind of recoil a little bit when you hear folk music. It sounds kind of wussy. You know, it's like, you know, when we were kids, we listened to rock and roll, and I don't know, folk music sounds like Froggy went a courting or something.
Hey, that's a good song.
Yes, but call it what you will. You don't have to call it
call
folk
it
music.
What you will.
But when did you discover the kind of music?
You know, there was a point
that you've included
in
O Brother and in Inside of Llewyn Davis.
Well, I was going to say, just
answer the question.
What Ethan just said, there was a point at which, you know, Bob Dylan was accused of abandoning folk music, and he said something like, "To me, folk music is a lot of fat people."
Yeah, you kind of know what he means. I don't know. T-Bone won't even say folk music. T-Bone Burnett, who we worked with, who worked on the music of this movie with us, as several other movies. T-Bone calls it American traditional music, which sounds hateful in another way.
The music that was being played, you know, in 1961, we were very, very young. So, I remember hearing it. You know, I actually remember my mother, you know, listening to or singing some of the stuff that was sort of part of that sort of folk music revival. And when we were kids, one record that we had was a record of a concert that Pete Seeger did with Big Bill Brunsey. It was recorded at a university in Chicago in 1957 that we listened to, and that we actually, when we made our second movie, Raising Arizona, we stole something from that, which was the idea of playing Beethoven on a banjo, something that Pete Seeger does on that record.
In the movie, there's Llewyn Davis is broke, and he's made his first solo album, and he's hoping, like, he doesn't even have money for a winter coat, so he's hoping he can collect some royalties on the solo album that he made. So there's a scene where he goes to the head of the record label he's recorded for, and this guy's also managing him, and it's this, like, elderly man who's very, like, old showbiz, old record industry, and he's there with his with an older woman who's his longtime secretary. And they kind of bicker like an old married couple. So anyway, so Llewyn Davis goes there to try to collect some money. And you can tell that the head of the record company has absolutely, like, no feeling for Llewyn Davis's music. I want to play this scene where he goes in. And again, Llewyn Davis is played by Oscar Isaac. The head of the record label, Mel Novikoff, is played by Jerry Grayson. And his secretary is played by Sylvia Quarters. Llewyn Davis speaks first.
How we doing?
We're doing great.
Really? New record's doing well?
How we doing? Not so hot, I gotta be honest. Ginny, where's Cincinnati?
What?
Cincinnati, it's not in here.
It should be in there.
It's not in here, I'm telling you. Is it?
Cincinnati?
Yeah.
I got it.
What?
I got it.
You got Cincinnati?
Yeah, you want it?
Could I have it?
Should I bring it in?
Yeah.
Do you owe me something? You have to owe me something.
I wish. People need time, you know, get to know you, buy you as a solo act, even know you're a solo act. Cincinnati is not good.
That's it, right?
Yeah, this is it. God help.
Nobody knew us when we were a duo. It's not like me and Mike were ever a big act. It's not a big re-education for the public. Mel? Mel!
How you doing, kid?
Boy, that sounds really good.
Isn't
on the radio.
Really good?
It should be a radio play.
It needs
like a few cheesy effects to make it a radio play. You know, a creaky door or something.
I love the way the agent and his secretary just keep repeating what each other said.
Uh-huh.
So is that exactly how you wrote it?
Yeah, pretty much.
So, did you know early in your career old showbiz agents like this guy?
No, we didn't. But actually, we did know from, well, I guess this is early in our career, when we used to work in the Brill Building, 1619 Broadway, which was Tin Pan Alley, exactly where these guys used to work from. And it was also a lot of cutting rooms in that building. And there were a lot of, not a lot, but there were a few old-timers still there when we were working in the Brill Building, and we would see them occasionally.
Yeah, so they had the pebble glass doors with the name of the company stenciled on the outside. I remember Johnny Marks Music was on the same hall we were on, our cutting room.
And there'd be, he'd be a guy who, in that case, I think he had like one song, like
Peter
Comes Peter Cottontail, that he sat in there. He's about 90 years old, and he would wait for the phone to ring in case anyone wanted to license it.
And so you had your editing room in the Brill Building?
Yeah, there were a lot of cutting rooms there. Actually, until quite recently, the last kind of movie post-production company just moved out recently.
I want to play another scene for you. And this is a scene. Llewyn Davis has been, he spent one night crashing at the home of a university professor who he knows. When he leaves in the morning, the couple who he's crashing with have already left. And when he leaves in the morning, the cat runs out the door of the apartment, and then the door slams behind him. So he's locked out, and meanwhile, the cat's running away, so he grabs the cat. And then the cat runs away from him, and then he finds the cat and returns the cat to the apartment. And so this is when he returns the cat to the apartment, and Mr. Gorfine, the university professor, opens the door, and there's a couple of friends at the apartment, too.
Oh, there's the cat.
Yeah.
Oh. Home from the hill. Hey, Llewyn, welcome. Come on in. Lillian's in the kitchen. She's making her famous moussaka.
No, I can't barge in for dinner. I just wanted to...
Oh, come on. One more person?
No, I can't.
Moussaka? Come on. Do you know Marty Green and Janet Fung?
Hello, nice to meet you, Llewyn Davis.
Oh, Mitch and Lillian's folk song friend.
You crashing with us?
Oh, no. I hadn't even planned on dinner.
Lewin's not an Upper West Side guy. We only get to see him when
I've rotated through my village friends.
Yeah, we're the last resort. Marty's in my department. And Joe's a musician. This is Joe Flom. He plays in Music at Antica with Lillian.
Oh. Oh. How you doing?
Nice to meet you.
Yes. What's your instrument?
Well, anything with a keyboard. I play celeste and harpsichord and M.A. I'm a piano instructor most days.
All right, bonus cigarette?
Oh, sure.
A glass of wine, Lewin? Little Dago Red?
Yeah. I should have brought something.
Well, hey, don't be silly. You brought the cat.
Right. You know, I used to take piano lessons when I was a kid from Mrs. Siegelstein. You don't know Mrs. Siegelstein, do you? Very, very big calves, orthopedic shoes. Lives in Far Rockaway upstairs from the Carlins.
Does she play early music?
Harry James on the radio. On the piano, Drink to Me Only with Thine Eyes.
Uh-huh.
She was not a swinger.
Well, Harry James.
Okay, yeah, well, her playing, though, was pretty on the beat.
That's a scene that from Inside Llewyn Davis. Doesn't work so well, you think?
It doesn't work as well as a radio play. I must say, you need the picture. You need the full horror of a little social conclave on the Jewish academic Upper West Side. Yeah, it kind of loses something there.
Well,
Okay.
Your parents were both, or are still both, university professors. Do you feel like you knew the Gorfines when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Tell us about the people you knew who you based it on, without mentioning names, of course.
Now you're trying to get me in trouble.
No, it's a world we know. Our parents were both academics in the Midwest, in our case, not on the Upper West Side. But, you know, academia is probably pretty similar everywhere.
Well, I like the way they provide the couch for Llewyn to sleep on, but Llewyn gives them, like, authenticity and, like, folk music credibility. He's their folk music friend.
Right. Maybe he, right. He keeps them feeling young. Yes. He's their young friend.
And their hip friend.
Right.
And I also like the way what they're serving is moussaka. I know people still eat moussaka, but moussaka was just like, it was one of these like ethnic dishes that was particularly popular in the 60s, I think.
Yeah.
Popular
new
in the 60s.
To a lot of people.
Right, it was exotic, but right, exactly. Later in the movie, he comes back and she's made her a tabbouleh salad.
Exactly. And he even has to pronounce it with a certain, like, ethnic flair, like with her moussaka.
Well, yes, that actually was a hallmark of my mother's cooking, too. She was, you know, an incredibly interesting, talented woman, but not a cook. She didn't really know how to do it, but she gave everything a try.
Now, something we couldn't see on the radio is that in the Gorfines' apartment is a very, like, artistic menorah. It's like a menorah where it's a little, like, abstracted.
Actually, there are several menorahs there. You could do a kind of Where's Wally or Where's Waldo thing looking for the menorahs in that Gorfines' apartment.
That's true. Actually, I think when we were cutting the movie at one point, I pointed out to you, I said, I think there are three menorahs in this one shot.
And are any of those from,
yeah,
like,
those
family collections
designs.
Or anything? Yes, exactly.
No, something we're very, also very familiar with, you know, something that we made more hay out of, perhaps, than A Serious Man. But we were into that whole 60s modernist Judaica aesthetic.
Right. And as I think everyone could tell from that scene, the main character, Llewyn Davis, just really has a talent for irritating people. He knows exactly how to do it.
Yeah, no, definitely. He's his own worst enemy, and he gets into trouble with people and probably realizes immediately after saying the wrong thing that he's said the wrong thing and probably feels bad about it. But then, you know, 10 minutes later, he'll say the wrong thing again.
Why did you want to give him the power to be that irritating to nearly everybody, including people who are his friends?
I don't know, because it's an interesting character. I mean, you know, we all know people like that. There's something interesting about that, and interesting about that, especially for a performer who's supposed to be ingratiating himself to people. I don't know. For us, it was just part of the, you know, the character that for us was compelling.
You had mentioned Bob Dylan earlier. Bob Dylan is not exactly in the movie, but he almost is, and there's a song of his that's on the soundtrack. I read in an article that he went to the same summer camp that you did, I presume not at the same time.
No, correct. Not at the same time. That might even be urban or Midwestern myth. But
no,
yeah, that was the myth.
No, it's not myth. Yeah. I think it's on, who is it wrote the book about him? Sean Wilentz.
Uh-huh.
I think if you go on his website or some other website having to do with Dylan, there are very early photographs of him in Herzl Camp.
That's funny.
Which is the camp in Webster, Wisconsin
where we both went. But yes, no, Bob went before us. He's older than us. We're catching up, but he's still older than us.
So I have to know, is this the kind of summer camp where you sing songs with lyrics about how great the camp is, and then there's team songs with how great the team is?
No.
No,
oh, no,
shucks.
No,
I wanted to think of him as singing those songs.
No, you sang, it was a Zionist summer camp, and you sang Zionist songs in Hebrew.
One of the people in your cast is Justin Timberlake, who plays a folk singer who's married.
Turning from the Jewish thing.
We're pretty sure Justin didn't go to that camp.
Yeah, no. Unless we're very much mistaken, the man is a Shagetz.
So he plays a folk singer who's married to a character played by Carey Mulligan. And did you approach him knowing that he could sing and knowing that he could act knowing that he could do comedy?
Yes,
yes, to
yes, all
three
of those things. He was one of the first people we thought about, actually, when we were casting the movie.
Well, I want to play a song that really features him, and this is 500 Miles. And he starts off singing it, and then Carey Mulligan is also on it, and Stark Sands, who plays a folk singer in the movie. And my favorite thing about this song, I don't know if you saw this, Janet Maslin, in reviewing some recent folk-related things, wrote about the soundtrack of the album, and she said that listening to the soundtrack before she'd seen the movie, she heard the beginning of the song and said, wow, she sounds just like Mary Travers. And then when she actually saw the movie, she realized that the person she was hearing at the beginning was Justin Timberlake. And not Carey Mulligan.
That's not surprising. I mean, you know, Justin can get up there. He's just unbelievable.
Well,
I mean,
you know, an interesting thing about that is he worked on the rest of the music in the movie, and in the Irish quartet that you hear in the movie singing the old triangle, That was one song, the one song in the movie that was not performed by the people that you see on screen. Those were actors lip-syncing to playback. And the bass part of that quartet is Justin Timberlake.
Now, you also wrote lyrics for a song that's a variation on an existing song or on several existing songs. So the song is called Please, Mr. Kennedy, and it's like, please, Mr. Kennedy, don't shoot me into outer space. But tell us about the song that it's based on, that you wrote new
lyrics
for.
There's another song. Yeah, there's another song. There's a song of the period, or maybe a couple years past our period, in the early, mid-60s, called Please, Mr. Kennedy. It was recorded by a West Coast kind of folk pop duo called the Gold Coast Singers. And lyrically, the idea of this, the original song was, Please, Mr. Kennedy, don't send me off into Vietnam, which was wrong for our period, and we kind of rewrote it as a novelty, poppy, please don't shoot me off in outer space. Supposedly it's John Glenn is singing, yeah, it's in the voice of John Glenn, who's about to be, shot into orbit.
Okay, so this is Please, Mr. Kennedy from the soundtrack of Inside Llewyn Davis, and it features Justin Timberlake, Oscar Isaac, and Adam Driver.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 second,
please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy,
uh-oh.
I want to go.
Don't shoot me in the outer space.
Bubble, helmet, flash, board, and boots. Nowhere up there,
outer.
In gravity zero.
Space.
I need to breathe,
outer.
Don't need to be a hero.
Space.
And are you reading me loud and clear? Oh, please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't wanna go.
Please don't show me
out of space.
Oh,
please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't wanna go.
Please don't show me
out of space. I'm 6'2".
That's music from the soundtrack of Inside Llewyn Davis, and my guests are Joel and Ethan Coen, who wrote and directed the film. Now that, since that's meant to be a novelty song, it made me think of what were the big novelty songs of that period. And one thing I remembered is like Alan Sherman's big hit album, My Son the Folk Singer, which was kind of like satires from a Jewish perspective with a lot of like Yiddish jokes in it. That was a hit in 1962, a year after This Is Made.
Yeah.
And you had referred to Alan Sherman in our previous interview when talking about the character of Cy Abelman in A Serious Man.
Well, I was going to actually, when you asked about what part folk music played in our lives earlier on in the interview, I was going to mention Alan Sherman because we had Alan Sherman records when we were kids. And you're right. In fact, we just recently did a concert in New York with all of our actors in the movie who sang in the movie and a lot of the musicians who worked on the music in the movie, and then lots of other people who were singing sort of old American folk songs and more contemporary music. And Gillian Welsh and Dave Rollins were involved in that, and it's always been a subject of sort of, an interesting thing between the two of us and Dave that he also used to listen to Alan Sherman when he was a kid, which I find very amusing.
But yeah, that was an early folk influence. My Son the Folk Singer, which I can picture vividly still, the album cover, and My Son the Nut, which was also a great album cover. And I think it was My Son the Nut that had Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, right?
Yeah, that was the one where he was buried up to his neck in nuts.
Yeah.
Folk
Somebody
music.
Just put out a biography of Alan Sherman called Overweight Sensation.
Really?
Which I'm anxious to read. Yeah, I haven't gotten it yet, but yes.
How many volumes?
So it's interesting. In some ways, I think of this as like your second musical, the first being Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Do you think of Inside Llewyn Davis as a musical, but, in a different kind of musical?
In a way, yeah.
Okay. There's a lot of music in it. Is that the standard? It's not a musical, certainly in the sense that we've never done one in this sense, that the characters kind of break into, unmotivatedly break into song. I mean, it's a music about a professional musician or somebody who's aspiring to be a professional musician. So it's all in a kind of a real context. But yes, in terms of the amount of music, okay, we'll call it a musical.
And do you like musicals at all?
Sure.
You're talking about Broadway musicals.
And movie musicals.
We're talking about movie musicals.
Yeah, that would include like Busby Berkeley and Fred Astaire. And
oh,
then
yeah.
Broadway.
Oh, yeah,
would
absolutely.
Include Stephen Sondheim. I mean,
yes.
Like the whole
yeah,
gamut.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. But Busby Berkeley is, you know, a radical sort of, and, you know, very, very interesting film artist. And those movies are fantastically interesting. There's fantastic musical numbers in those movies.
You didn't think about that at all when making your, quote, musicals?
Well, no, we didn't, but we've thought about them in the context of other musical numbers in movies that we've done, specifically in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, we did one thing in The Big Lebowski that was kind of, yeah, specifically, it was very consciously, self-consciously a Busby Berkeley number.
Wait, refresh my memory.
Jeff Bridges, the Jeff Bridges character is oh my God, I'm going to try to synopsize it and it'll sound demented. He's doped by a pornographer played by Ben Gazzara, and when he's in a, you know, heightened state, he has a dream about this woman played by Julianne Moore in which bowling figures, and it's a Busby Berkeley musical number.
He goes under the legs of these sort of Koreans on a bowling alley. And it's all to a Kenny Rogers tune called I Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Is In.
Oh, okay. You know, I saw The Big Lebowski again when it was released like one night only in movie theaters like two summers ago maybe.
Uh-huh.
It's just amazing how, what a huge following that film got in its afterlife. You know, like after it closed in movie theaters. How did that happen?
Yeah.
It's a great film, but I mean, how did it develop that afterlife? Do you have any idea?
Well, it developed the afterlife on home video. You're right. It came out in movie theaters. It didn't do, you know, particularly outstanding business in the theatrical market, but it did in the home video market.
Yeah,
and then it became sort of, you know, some cult thing. I don't know how do you explain that? I have no idea. It's certainly one of the more bizarre afterlives to any of the things that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
We were in a movie theater together with our families a year or two ago in San Francisco, and coming down from a movie, and we saw there was a little booth set up with Big Lebowski posters on it, a young woman sitting on the other side of this table, maybe 17 or 18 years old, and Ethan stopped and said, "What is this?" And she said, "Oh, well, we show The Big Lebowski every night, and people come dressed up in costumes, and you should come. You'll like it. It's fun."
Did she know who you were?
No.
That's great. Who would you come dressed as?
We stay away from those things.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. In your previous movie, which we talked about when we came out, True Grit, you had to direct a lot of horses in really tough scenes to direct. And you had to really, of course, be very careful in how you treated the horses. In your new movie, the tough animal scenes have to do with a cat or a couple of cats. So how do you cast a cat for your film?
Ooh, that was horrible. We just used, on the advice of the cat trainer, the animal trainer, kind of a marmalade tabby cat, just because they're, you know, common, so easy to double, triple, quadruple. There were, you know, many cats playing the one cat. And, you know, the whole thing is actually pretty, it comes across well in the movie, but the whole exercise of shooting a cat is pretty nightmarish because they don't care about anything. They don't want to do what you want them to do. As the animal trainer said to us, a dog wants to please you, a cat only wants to please itself. It was just long, painstaking, frustrating days shooting the cat.
What you have to do is basically find the cat that's predisposed to doing whatever particular piece of action it is that you have to film. So you find the cat that isn't afraid to run down a fire escape, or this, you know, the cat that's very docile and will let the actor just hold them for extended periods of time without being fidgety, and then you want the fidgety cat and the squirrely cat for when you want the cat to run away, and you just keep swapping them out depending on what the task at hand is.
You know, in True Grit, we had a vulture, a trained vulture, which who knew there were such, but, you know, that was a pain. And it was even, like, you know, by vulture standards, probably a stupid vulture, and that was frustrating. But, you know, I would take a vulture over a cat. The cat was just horrible.
Well, you know, it's funny. I have this recurring. I have a cat.
Should have written it as a vulture. They slip out of the Corfine's apartment. They have a flies vulture.
Yeah.
I have a cat, and I have this recurring dream that I take the cat outdoors, and I'm holding the cat in my arms, and the cat runs away, and I know I'll never be able to find it. And that's kind of what happens.
It's probably
in the movie.
A good thing.
What's a good thing?
We're not big cat lovers.
Why not? Because of this movie?
Well, mostly for this experience, yeah.
So this movie is kind of an anxiety dream for you.
Yes, exactly. I've had this dream so many times, without the singing, of course. So your movie's called Inside Llewyn Davis, and Dave Van Ronk was the initial inspiration for the movie, and he has a movie, an album called Inside Dave Van Ronk, and on the cover, he's standing in a doorway of what I assume is a Greenwich Village storefront or apartment, and there's a cat in the doorway. Was that cat an inspiration at all for having a
no,
cat?
No, here's what's very interesting. First of all, I think I was told that that doorway is McSorley's Ale House.
Oh, really?
That's where they shot that. Although I didn't know that until recently. Because when we did our own sort of copy of that album cover, we thought, you know, we were looking around in the village for doorways that were the same or similar to that in order to sort of copy that album. But the fact that there's a cat in the doorway, believe it or not, we did not notice and was pointed out to us by an art director after we'd written the script and when we were actually in post-production on the movie. And that was a little shocking to us.
There should have been a vulture in the doorway.
So both O Brother, Where Art Thou? And Inside Llewyn Davis refer in some way to Ulysses or the Odyssey. Did you read that? Did that make a big impact on you, or is it just kind of coincidental?
We haven't read it yet.
It's pre-influenced.
It's on our list. It's on our list.
We've made two movie versions of it, and we're going to read it soon.
Yeah. It's right at my bedside table, and I keep looking over at it and going, ugh.
I hear it's a good book.
But you are doing a film, I understand. Your next film is going to be set in ancient Rome. Is that true?
Well, part of it is set in ancient Rome.
Can you tell us anything about the forthcoming movie?
We don't know that it actually is going to be the next movie. You know, we're in the middle of writing the script, and quite honestly, I mean, you know, we often start these things, get a certain distance with them, and then put them aside for a while. They generally get finished eventually and even made eventually, but not necessarily without sort of digressions into other projects.
It's not really ancient Rome. It's 1950 Hollywood, and they're making a movie about ancient Rome. So, if you know, for what it's worth.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's about a movie that's being made in 1950 about ancient Rome called Hail Caesar.
Oh, that's great. Since you're writing a movie together now, can I ask you a little bit about what the writing process is when you write a movie together? Do you write in the same room together? Do you share ideas after you've written separately?
It's mostly napping.
We go to the office, you know, we're there, we're in a room together. We take naps, but, you know, the important thing, we're there at the office should we be inspired to actually write something. No, we don't split it up. We don't sort of, one of us won't write something and then give it to the other to react to. We actually kind of talk through whatever we're doing together.
Do you do the dialogue out loud with each other as if you were characters?
Well, sometimes, but it doesn't exactly work like that. It's more... You know, there's so much talking involved. There's so much conversation involved around the whole thing. And a lot of the conversation has to do with specific things that people say in a scene, right? So one of us may, and they're in, that may be in the context of talking about something completely different from the dialogue. But then that comes up, and then that's the one of us may say something about that, and then the other person may just sort of answer it with what might come next. But it's also the case that frequently Ethan will just sit down, or I'll sit down and at the computer and just type up dialogue in a scene, you know, and then the other person will look at it and maybe adjust it or change it or something like that. But it's all in the context of this ongoing conversation.
Because you edit together, I don't know, I shouldn't say because I don't really know why you do this, but you edit together and you edit under the name Roderick Janes. Why did you need like a pseudonym to edit, and does that name refer to anybody? Where does that name come from?
It doesn't refer to anyone. It's just something Meg grabbed out of the air. We just used the pseudonym Cutting because our names are in the credits so many times already that adding one more just seemed like bad taste. Yeah, that's really the reason.
It's a very un-Jewish sounding name, I'll say that.
Oh, yes, yeah. Certainly is. in fact, we sort of invented a whole persona for this guy
in the introduction
to one of our screenplays.
He's British, as it turns out. He's written introductions to a few of our screenplays, published screenplays.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So tell me more about him.
Well, we actually had to come up with a bio for him. You know, when you need bios for the personnel of your movies for various, I don't even know why, for PR purposes. But I can't remember what we had him doing. He started out minding the tea cart in Shepperton Studios, and he's very old, in his 80s, actually, when we first started working with him, which would make him probably over 100 now.
Yeah, he lives in Haywards Heath, Sussex.
Well, it's been so much fun talking with you both. Congratulations
likewise,
on the new
Terry.
Film, and thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having us.
Joel and Ethan Coen wrote and directed the new film Inside Llewyn Davis. Before making the film, they optioned the late folk singer Dave Van Ronk's memoir, even though Davis is not supposed to be Van Ronk. Dave Van Ronk has a song on the soundtrack. He performed on our show in 1988. You can hear two of the songs from that broadcast on our blog, which is on Tumblr. That's at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. You'll also find a link there to Milo Miles' review of the recently released Van Ronk album, Down in Washington Square, the Smithsonian Folkways Collection. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker's 10 Best List. This is Fresh Air.